tomorrow. So in that lecture, we will, I'll take a lot of questions. Maybe you have questions about where the future of this field is going. And so bring all manner of questions for that last session. I'll keep sufficient time for these discussions. What I want to do now is just carry on with the Ginzburg-Landau theory that we developed last time. As you notice, we were going through these two equations and seeing them in action under different conditions. So we looked at the behavior near a wall. And so first of all, we looked at a completely homogeneous superconductor where no gradient terms were present and no magnetic fields were present. And that gave us the basic theory of the second order phase transition that these equations describe. The second thing we did was to put a wall, and we saw how the order parameter varies near the wall. And Pei Feng brought up a very interesting, important question about whether the boundary term was being satisfied or not. So we got this linear decrease of the order parameter. And if it's linear, then the gradient term indeed does not vanish according to that boundary condition. So I don't have time to go into this, but I thought a lot about that question later at night. And what is missing is, and this is something we should, you should think about more later, but near a wall, what we said was that the order parameter psi as a function of x would come down like this. But then it does not satisfy the gradient condition, the vanishing of the gradient. So I think what should happen here is that our assumption that the order parameter was purely real actually breaks down. When the order parameter becomes very small, phase fluctuations will start to happen and that assumption breaks down. So that needs to be looked at more carefully near the x equal to 0 point. Okay, and unfortunately, I can't go into that right now because I have things to get to related to vortices and the Josephson effect. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is to continue looking at these equations when there is a magnetic field. We started on this. We saw how there was that current, the superfluid current that was set up prevent the magnetic field from getting in, but the currents flowed over some length scale, which was the penetration depth. But let's look at this a little more in detail. Let me start out by showing you some experimental data on these vortices. Can I have the screen, please? Hello? Can I have the screen, please? Okay, this is really nice. It's taken me a while, but I've collected data from many different sources. So if you have questions, ask me as I go along, as I show you each slide. Okay, let me skip this. Let me just get to the actual data, okay. So here, what you are seeing is a superconductor like lead. A magnetic field has been put on this lead film, or rather lead cylinder. Actually, it's a cube, as you see from the cross section. And what happens is, initially, the magnetic field is being expelled for low fields, okay? The magnetic field is being expelled, and so inside, there would be no magnetic field. But then you cross a particular magnetic field called HC1, and now the magnetic field starts to penetrate in the form of these vortices. We will do a lot of derivations for these vortices shortly, but I want you to get an idea of what they look like. So a vortex, this is now looking at a cross-section from the top. Okay, so what you have to imagine is this film, is this system here. Okay, it's in a magnetic field. Here's the magnetic field. And the magnetic field has penetrated inside the superconductor when H is bigger than a certain value. So here is the phase diagram, H as a function of temperature. This is TC. This is what we call HC1. Below HC1, there is the Meissner phase of complete flux exclusion. But then if you sit at a temperature and keep increasing the field, at some point beyond HC1, the first vortex penetrates the system. And what is a vortex? A vortex is a core, so it has a core, which is normal. Okay, it's not superconducting, it's normal. And around the core, you have these circulating currents, these supercurrents that we talked about, circulating around the core. And it has a certain profile, a magnetic field profile and a current profile that circulates around the core. So the core is normal, and the core at the center carries an external magnetic field, which is equal to H external. That's the field here. But then as you go away from the core, so here is B as a function of, let's say, some radial coordinate. Here it is H external, and then it decreases as you go away from the core. This is the, and this decrease is on a scale lambda L. Okay? So is everybody clear as to what we are looking at and where in the phase diagram we are? Okay? Is everybody clear about that? Okay. So now what happens is as you keep increasing the magnetic field beyond HC1, oops, here, let me get another chalk. And this is the vortex phase. Okay, so this phase. That's what we are looking at. As you keep increasing the magnetic field beyond HC1, you get into a state where you have now many vortices. Each vortex is this normal core structure, and different vortices interact with some interaction, which we will derive. And because of this interaction, it's like having a crystal where you had atoms with some interactions and they formed a lattice. It's the same story here. These vortices interact and they end up making a lattice, which is usually a triangular lattice. So you have different vortices and they have some interaction between them. So vortex interaction. And that leads to a vortex lattice. It's also called the Abrikosov lattice because he first proposed this. Okay, now the way these things have been imaged is really interesting. They just throw some iron filings. Do you know what iron filings are? Little shavings of iron, and they drop it on the surface of the superconductor. And what does that iron filing do? It goes and gets attracted to wherever the magnetic field is present. So for the most part of the superconductor, there's no magnetic field, but in the core, which is normal, there is the external field coming out. They get attracted to those places and collect. And so these dots are literally imaging the cores of those vortices. So it's not a very perfect lattice because, you know, typically there is disorder and so on, and there are thermal fluctuations, but this is a very early identification of these vortices in 1967. Okay, now more recently, this is another material, niobium diselenide, and these are now images taken with scanning tunneling spectroscopy, and once again you see these very sharp spots are, so what you're trying to do is tunnel into the system, okay, with electrons. You're bringing a tip and you're trying to tunnel in. Now, as you know, in a superconductor, there's a gap, so you cannot tunnel into the superconducting regions, and they are dark. But the cores are normal, so you, the electron can tunnel into the normal region because there are available states. And so that's what you see, very sharp spots at the locations of the cores of these vortices. Yeah?
And what are those lines which are also visible?
You notice that. So those lines, so it turns out niobium diselenide is a little more complicated. In addition to superconductivity, it has also a charge density wave. Okay, we haven't talked about that, but electrons in a superconductor, if you look at the density of electrons, it's always uniform, right? The electrons don't have any density pattern. But sometimes the density of electrons can also get modulated. It's like having an electron crystal. So it's a little another story going on where, in addition to the superconductor, the electron density is also getting modulated, and it's picking up that modulation. So it's really quite a sensitive probe. But you can see how beautiful this data is. It's very nice triangular crystal, and it's being observed not with iron filings anymore. It's a 20th century experiment with scanning tunneling spectroscopy. Okay, now we come to, so another thing I want to point out, I talked about non-interacting Bose gas, weakly interacting Bose gas, then strongly interacting superfluid helium-4, and then we went to superconductors, which were Cooper pairs. And generally, this is all in the same, we talk about all of these systems in the same language. So nowadays, when I say superfluid, I can mean a fermionic, bosonic, any kind of superfluid. It's a general term for a system that has this complex scalar order parameter. Okay? So when I say superfluid, you should think of any of these possibilities. So here, I go to helium-4. And in helium-4, of course, it is not charged. So you might ask, what is this vortex we are talking about? So the same thing effect that you achieve with a vector potential, you can achieve by rotation. And you can show that the mathematics is exactly the same. The rotation omega cross r is just like having a magnetic field. So in helium, what is done is to take that system, you remember we talked about the torsional oscillator, and we were rotating that cylinder to measure how much of the liquid is moving with the walls and how much is disengaging. In that situation, we were trying to avoid any vortices. So the rotation frequency, which is the analog of the magnetic field, was very low. So you were in the Meissner phase. But now, if you increase the rotational frequency, you're going up like this, and you're entering the vortex phase. And that's what is shown here. These are now little, just like your bathtub, whirlpools of superfluid going round and round. The difference is that these vortices are quantized. So another thing I should have said, that if I look at the flux around a vortex, so if I look at A dot dl, this is going to be phi naught. And this is the flux quantum. Phi naught is h over e. So let me just say e star. So there's an analog of that for helium as well, even if it's not charged, but each unit there is one rotational flux quantum. And as you increase the rotational frequency, these vortices in helium more and more will pop up, and they will also, in the perfect situation, make a triangular lattice. Okay. Now, so that was helium. Now we look at BEC, Bose-Einstein condensates. So this is in rubidium. And, you know, now all of you have seen my talk. You know these optical lattices. This is not even with the lattice. This is just a parabolic potential in which you trap these bosons. And then you rotate them somehow. And when these are rotated, once again, you see these black spots. These are the vortices. Now, what does the black spot mean? It means actually a hole. So what you get is the analog of the normal core here is a hole. And around the hole, there is circulation of the superfluid. And the amount of circulation is exactly one quantum. So these are in a different system. Now, what is the point of doing these different experiments? It's to test for coherence. If you did not have this kind of long-range phase coherence, you could not make a vortex, because it's only the long-range phase coherence which you try to twist around in a circle. You must get one quantum only for a superfluid. So if you see vortices, that is a true test that you have a long-range phase coherent system of whatever kind. So this is BEC. And this gives you a little idea how they rotate these. They actually do it with what is called a laser spoon. So they take these two laser spots and they rotate it. And that effectively, in the frame of the rotational frame, it's like having a magnetic field. Okay, so these are even nicer vortices. Now seen in a fermionic system. Okay, so I'm slowly moving now from bosonic to fermionic. This is a Fermi system with spin up and spin down fermions. When they are, and you can change the attraction between them. So this, I was one day discussing this on the board through an interaction coupling strength G. This is that coupling strength. When it's very, very weak, you get these large Cooper pairs. And you can see vortices in that system. You can also tune the coupling. And this can be done by using a magnetic field. It's a very beautiful effect in atomic physics called Feshbach resonance. But it allows you to have a continuous probe, a continuous knob on the tuning parameter. And you can tune all the way to a very large attraction. So you get a BEC limit. And these are the vortices in that limit as well. And there are some nice physics you can do with the structure of the vortices and many things. Okay, so that's completes this. So I've shown you material systems, atomic systems, helium, all of that. And now we are going to do some calculations and see what the profiles are, what are the velocities, the structure, and so on. But I want to show you one last thing about something which will be beyond what we will do. We are going to do a mean field theory for these vortices, and I want to show you situations where that mean field theory will break down. This is not something we'll do in detail, but I want you to have this idea as we get into the more theoretical stuff. So this is what the kind of phase diagram we can derive from Ginzburg-Landau. The HT plane, Meissner state, abricots of lattice. But in these high-temperature superconductors, what happens is that these are very two-dimensional, and the TCs are really high compared to the usual superconductors. So these vortex lines are no longer straight. They can start to bend because they can get entropic. They can gain entropy by doing that. And you can go into a state where this lattice can melt just like a crystal. Just like you have atoms and they make crystals, these crystals melt. Similarly, this vortex lattice melts. It's this object of lines, and it can undergo melting. And you can get these kinds of phases. So the phase diagram changes to something like that. There is the Meissner phase, a lattice phase, and then a melting line, which separates the lattice and the liquid. which is really cool. This is a new kind of liquid, of lines. And they can also measure. Now you might say, melting, can they really see? You know, you have your picture of ice and liquid and melting, first order transitions. They can see all of that. It's really beautiful experiments. They have made these sort of hall bars. We don't need to go into those details. But what you need to know is you can go in and locally measure the magnetic field on this vortex lattice. And this is what they see. Okay, so these are really, really nice experiments. They are measuring the local magnetic field B. The external magnetic field is H. There's all that magnetization stuff. B is the effective magnetic field as a function of temperature. So what are they doing? Let me just go to that one. So they will sit at one temperature, go up in field, and try to see what happens at this transition. Or you can fix the field and go up in temperature and try to cut the transition line this way. So you can do a field scan or a temperature scan. And what they see is this very nice jump. So there is the solid phase, and then the local magnetic field jumps, showing that there is a first order melting transition, and then you get into the liquid. And the same thing in the field scan. And from this, you can get these lines that I told you about the melting line. You can draw the melting line. And it basically shows that you don't get the lattice all the way till HC2. In between, there is this intervening liquid, which is quite a bit like the ice liquid transition. Okay, yeah.
If you try to go to HC0, does it become continued?
Yeah, that's a good point. What happens as T equal to zero here? In the high temperature superconductors, this is an unattainable magnetic field. It's very, very large. But theoretically, this is a very interesting transition because it becomes a quantum transition. And it should become a continuous transition at that point. But you have to look at Landau orbits by these large magnetic fields. Yeah, but that's a very, and again, that is not very well understood. So, HC2 within mean field, we can find that point. But once you have these very large magnetic fields, it becomes extremely quantum in that limit. So this is also not very well understood in this way as to what will happen there.
For conventional superconductors, is it achievable H2? HC2.
Yes, yes.
And to zero temperature.
Yes, but what happens there is these are fairly low fields. These are not very high. So if you could get relatively higher fields and go towards zero temperature, that would be a quantum transition. So what am I talking about? What I'm talking about is this is a lattice. It's a classical lattice. But if I look at zero temperature, this lattice can melt because of quantum effects. That's what we are talking about. So you might recall I had talked about electron lattice melting because of quantum effects. And we had looked at, I'd called it a Wigner lattice, and how just by changing the kinetic energy, the lattice could melt. And there's no temperature involved in that melting. It's melting because of quantum effects. The same thing can happen here. This line can bend, and there can be a liquid phase which goes all the way to zero temperature. That would be a quantum liquid of vortices. And whenever you say quantum, you should imagine some tunneling events, which is destroying the lattice. So a lattice, the cores sit in very definite positions, but if these are quantum objects, these vortices will start to tunnel from one side to another, and that is what will cause the lattice to melt. Okay? So, in other words, there are many exciting things from all these things. It never ends. Okay, so now what can we do? We can do mean field theory. We can do Ginzburg-Landau. So let's see. Let's try to see what that gets us. Okay, can we have the screen off? Okay. So I've been using some words a bit loosely, like superfluid currents or superfluid velocities, and it was brought, and I want to sort of clarify that a little bit more. So let's look at the gradient term. In the Ginzburg-Landau equation. So the order parameter psi of r is psi e to, mod psi e to the I theta. And if I take the gradient of psi, then I get del mod psi So this is the part that we call bend order parameter bending. And this is the part, del theta, that we associate with superflow. So if I take things like del psi mod square, I'm going to have mod psi square Now, I think this should clarify a lot of things, because when we are ignoring the phase, then we are just talking about the changes of the magnitude of the order parameter. And then when we have, we also look at gradients of the phase, that tells us about superflow. So I want to go through that argument slowly. Why is it superflow? So let me write down the general order parameter again in this way. C down x and x is r plus rho over 2 and x prime is r minus rho over 2. So this r is a center of mass coordinate, and rho is a relative coordinate. Okay, so if I'm thinking of a Cooper pair, one is the center of mass of the Cooper pair, and rho is the relative coordinate. Given one electron, what is the wave function around it? That's what the relative coordinate tells us. And the other one is the center of mass of the Cooper pair. Now, if I put that in here for x and x prime, and I Fourier transform it, I will get a sum over k and a sum over q. And this would be c minus k plus q over 2 down c. All of that times e to the ik dot, say, minus ik dot rho and e to the iq dot r. So at rho equal to 0 and with, let's say, single queue mode, then my order parameter psi of r becomes sum over k c minus k plus q over 2 down c k plus q over 2 up okay. So this is a condensate. It's a condensate with finite center of mass momentum. And now, I can define the superfluid velocity Vs as h bar q over 2m. Yeah. And now you can see that for uniform flow, psi of r would be mod psi e to the I 2m over h bar vs, which tells us that theta is or gradient of theta is and more generally, if you had also theta varying in position, then we can write down gradient of theta at each point r is 2m over h bar vs of r. Yes. No, I'm not using that. I'm just defining this quantity.
Okay, but like the superfluid velocity would contain the vector potential, right?
So,
if you're talking about the physical superflow,
so the actual current would contain the vector potential as well. But this is what we would call the superfluid velocity. Okay, so I wanted to just make that very clear. And now if I look at k times that gradient term, this would be equal to, say, k times the magnitude as we just wrote down, square plus I'm trying to give you a little better understanding of this gradient of theta and the velocity and the center of mass. That's the main thing I wanted to get across. So, you know, when we wrote the order parameter, because we have written the order parameter several times in different ways depending on what we need. So, The correct definition, if you have two fermions, would be C at X and C at X prime. That is this is the Cooper pair, and it is targeting even the internal structure. And what I'm saying is, we had defined it. Then we did the Fourier transform. Previously, we did not have this Q. We just said we have a Cooper pair at minus k down and k up. So we had just set the center of mass to zero. And that was okay, we were just studying a condensate that was not moving. But now that we are putting these gradient terms, the condensate is going to move. And when I say it moves, I have to target the center of mass of the condensate. And the velocity of that superfluid will be related to gradients taken with respect to the center of mass coordinate.
Because like the it's defined, you know, the phase is coherent everywhere. Right?
Yeah, so it's completely coherent everywhere. It's the same.
So and that's the superconducting state, right? So if you deviate, if you have one region that deviates away from that, then wouldn't it correct for itself?
Yeah, but it may not be able to correct it. For example, if you have first finish your question. Let me see.
Well, that's what I mean. So the superflow is like the correction, sort of trying to correct for itself, right? But wouldn't that end at some point?
So
to return back to this.
You can apply a magnetic field which forces it to have boundary conditions such that you have put a net, you've put some net twist in the theta. And in that situation, the superflow will never change. For example, that's why I want to make that connection there. When you apply a magnetic field, right, there are screening currents which are set up. What exactly is that screening current? The screening current is this Vs running around the system. So for example, let's take the core. Here is the core. The magnetic field sets up these screening currents which are now rotating around the core. The gradient of the phase never vanishes because you have forced boundary conditions such that the gradient has been established and the superflow around it is constant in this situation. And the velocity profile changes as you go out radially. So as I look as a function of r, this is 0, the velocity is going to be very large near the core. And it's going to be, so the velocity Vs is going to look like this. Okay, it's very large near the core because the gradients are large, but as you go away, finally deep in the superfluid, there are no gradients because now the system has come back to what it would like to be in perfect equilibrium with all the phases lined up. So here the phases are lined up, here there are gradients, and the gradients are stronger as you go toward the edge, toward the core. Or if you are doing Meissner effect, then it's largest at the wall. Okay, so we get this, and if I just look at this term, then you can see this is h bar square over 4m. I'm just substituting for k. The magnitude is the superfluid density. I'm going to divide it by 2 just to get the Cooper pair density. And then I have 2m Vs over h bar square. And if you put it all together, this comes out to be half m n Vs square, which is half rho Vs, rho s Vs square. Okay, so these equations are very helpful in thinking about the gradient and how that leads to the superfluid density. And that was the way I introduced it when we did helium 4. But all these things are completely connected. Okay, so now what we want to do is to look at the superconductor in a magnetic field and try and understand the Abrikosov lattice. Okay, so so we have these two lengths, C and lambda. And what we want to understand is the energy of an interface between a superconductor and a normal state, because that's what a vortex is. The vortex core is normal, the rest of it is superconducting, and there is some interfacial energy at the boundary. So here's the interface, and we want to calculate the surface tension. So in general, from the superconducting side, I will have an order parameter which decays, which is constant in the superconductor and decreases as you come to the boundary, finally vanishing into the normal state. And there is some healing length over which it changes, and that is our Xi. So this scale is Xi. At the same time, there's a magnetic scale, which is coming down. So the magnetic field in the normal state is equal to the external field. And then as I come toward the superconductor, it's going to start to decrease. And it'll decrease on some scale here, which is lambda L. Let me put down lambda L 0 and Xi 0. Why am I putting zeros? Because what we derived yesterday was that Xi, we showed yesterday that Xi of t was Xi 0 t to the minus half. And lambda L of t was some prefactor lambda L 0 t to the minus half. So what is important are these prefactors. Okay, so what we are going to show, let me tell you the result, and then I'll just sketch how we will get there. But what we are going to show is that there's a parameter kappa, which is lambda L0 divided by Xi0. And we will show that there will be some surface energy because of this boundary, and that surface energy is, I'm going to define that to be integral dx. This direction here is x. This is minus infinity here. That's infinity. This is zero. So from minus infinity to infinity, the difference in free energy densities. So this is the Gibbs free energy density. Okay. So I'm going to look at that difference in energy integrated, and really I'm looking at the contribution from that surface interfacial layer. And that will turn out to be 8c squared over 8 pi times minus lambda L. So I will sketch the proof, but I want to give you an idea what we are going to conclude from this. So what we are going to see is that there is one parameter kappa, which is this ratio of these two lengths, and that will control, depending on which one is greater, it will control whether the surface energy is negative or positive. And that will define for us what kind of superconductor we will get. Will it be one which will allow vortices to enter, or will it be one which will just remain in the Meissner phase? And these are called type 1 and type 2 superconductors. So I will define that in a bit, but I wanted you to have an idea where we are headed. So everything hinges on getting this interfacial energy. So I am trying to see, because I'm a little bit short of time, what I should do. Okay, so let me sketch it in the following way. An interfacial energy, or surface energy, you can call it something like that. Okay, so what I'm going to do is, let's see, I have del dot, I'm going to work in a gauge. I'm going to pick a gauge where del dot A is 0, and that will give me, so I'm going to just sketch the proof, because it'll take me, I want to get to a couple of other things. So, but that should be enough. So I'm going to take A in the y direction, but varying along x. So let me draw my geometry again. So here is the x direction, this is y, and this is z coming out. Okay, so A will be in the, okay, how did I drew the magnetic field up. Okay, so let me draw this to be z, this is y. Okay, so x, y, and then z. So my vector potential points in the y direction, and it has some variation, which gives me then B is going to be curl of A, and that will be that will give me B in the z direction, which will be del AY by del X. Okay, so with that, you can then get the Gibbs free energy, G, which is F minus, remember we talked about these different free energy potentials, and I discussed how we want the Gibbs one, because that works with the external field as the free parameter, as the independent parameter, rather than the magnetization. So this is the Helmholtz free energy minus H dot B over 4 pi. Okay, so for the normal state, it will be F without the magnetic field plus 8c square over 8 pi. That's the normal state free energy, because it's just the whatever it is without the magnetic field plus this increase in a magnetic field. And the superconducting one, Fs, will be what you get from the Ginzburg-Landau functional. So this is the Ginzburg-Landau free energy. And from here then, you can show that gamma, which I have defined to be that integral that integral will turn out to be 8c square over 8 pi times 1 minus b over 8c whole square minus psi over psi infinity to the fourth power. If psi infinity was the value at, actually I should say psi minus infinity, but it's that value deep in the superfluid. You want psi minus infinity. Okay, so that's the kind of equation you can derive. And I'm skipping a few steps, but you'll get something like this. What I want to sort of point out is where do these different length scales come in? The different analysis with the different length scales. So here we can look at two situations. One is kappa. Let me just do it here. So this is kappa much, much greater than 1. And let us try to plot that. So in this case, so kappa, once again, is lambda L0 over C0. It's kappa. So lambda is much bigger than C0. That means it looks like this. At the boundary, this is like that. And the field is like this. So this is B of x, and this is psi of x. And in the other case, when kappa is much smaller, then we have the order parameter is changing on a very long scale, but the field is very short. So this is B of x. And this is psi of x. Okay? So that's what we have. And now we can analyze that equation in these two regimes very easily, because in one regime, in this one, we will ignore the order parameter in the interface. So ignore variation of psi and just take B of x to be h0 e to the minus x over lambda l. And when you put that into this equation and integrate it, you will find that this interfacial energy is hc square over 8 pi times lambda l with a negative sign. And when you do the same, when you try to do this integral on the other side, where I will now ignore B, so in this side, ignore B, then you will get that gamma NS is 8C square over 8 pi C naught with a plus sign. Okay, so what that means is when there's a negative sign, that means the system wants to make lots of interfaces. So this is the case that leads to vortices. So in other words, vortices are seen in superconductors that have kappa much, much bigger than 1. Whereas in this case, where the interfacial energy is positive, then the system minimizes interfaces. OK, so if you combine the two, you can sort of write that equation which I had above. Okay, can you see both? Yeah. Okay, so, yeah. Lambda?
In both curves.
Oh, lambda. This distance here, this distance here is C. C naught. And lambda is sort of the length scale. It's a much bigger length scale. Let's say of this much. That is lambda naught. And here, it's the other way around. It's the scale over which the blue line is varying, the order parameter. That is now C. and lambda is now about. Okay. So now, if we look at, is the writing getting too tiny there? Can you see that? I should probably get a little larger. Okay. This is like one crucial analysis we have to do to understand which regime of these superconductors we have to be in to get these vortices. So we want to look at the kappa much, much greater than one. And in those situations, now try to find these critical fields. So I'm looking at kappa much greater than one. And I want to look at H over temperature and ask, what is hc1 of t and hc2 of t? That's tc. And once again, let me give you the result. I think there's a... So for... This is called type 2. And these are called type 1. And this only has one. Okay, and let's just let me just put down what these fields will turn out to be. So a very good way to always estimate these fields is to think of the Aronov-Bohm effect and the fact that field times the length square is a flux. So we have two lengths, c and lambda. What are all the fields we can make out of it? So one is we can say C square times a field. So we are going to do length square times a field, H, goes like phi naught. And so we can do C square times H goes like phi naught. And this turns out to be HC2. It's the biggest field, because in this type two case, C is a very small length compared to lambda. So HC2 correspondingly is a large field. And then I can also have lambda square times HC1 goes like phi naught. And these will be the two fields that I will define for a type 2 superconductor. So this is type 2. And in the type 1 case, it is C times lambda times HC, which goes like phi naught. So that's basically how these fields come in. And it's good to keep this in mind because it's a, you know, you can carry this along with you. But more precisely, what you will get when you solve the Ginzburg-Landau equations is that HC1 of t will go like phi naught over 4 pi lambda L square times log kappa. Log kappa is anyway just a number, so that's why I had those squiggles there. And HC2 of T will turn out to be phi naught over 2 pi C square. There's a T dependence here if you want. Okay, this is the full thing. And I don't really remember those prefactors there, but it should be also of that kind for HC. Okay, so these are the fields that we will get. Now, exactly how they are obtained, let's discuss that a bit. Did I erase the Ginsburg equation? Ginsburg. I did erase it. Never mind. I'm going to skip the HC1 calculation. Let me just illustrate the HC2 calculation, and you can do similar things. A good reference for this is Tinkham's book on superconductivity. So HC2, what you're doing is you're looking at the phase boundary where the order parameter is becoming very small, right? Because beyond the HC2, order parameter goes to zero. That's the definition of the superconducting to normal transition. So we will assume that psi of r is small at that boundary and ignore the beta term in the equation, in equation 1. And then we'll get this equation, minus h bar square over 2m star del what you are seeing is this condensate. That's all these equations we write down every time are treating this condensate like a particle. Effectively, you have seen such things written for an electron in a magnetic field. This big condensate, which carries many, many electron and Cooper pairs with it, is like a wave function that, even though it's for these many particles, because they move coherently, it's like the wave function of a particle. And so that's what you get from that Ginsburg-Landau first equation. And I've ignored the beta term. Now, this looks just like a particle in a magnetic field. So of course, the solutions have to be what? Landau levels. So this will give you Landau levels for, usually in these levels, what sits in these levels are electrons. What will sit here is the condensate. So it's like a particle in a magnetic field. And that gives Landau levels. Okay. So I'm just going to borrow the result from there, which is that your eigenvalues will be n plus half h bar omega c and that must be equal to, so I'm solving this eigenvalue equation. I'm going to take the z part of it and the alpha term to the other side. And so this will be equal to minus alpha minus h bar square over 2m star kz square. And if I substitute for alpha in terms of xi, I get h bar square over 2m star okay, where I have used and also we know that omega c is E star EB over MC, so it's E star H0 over MC. And we have a length, a magnetic length and all that. And OK, so that's what we get. Now, from here, we can solve. So this is our equation. Actually, you can look at it in more detail. You can look at the eigenfunctions and so on. I'm just going a little fast through this. I'm trying to get the HC2 at out of this equation, which is the maximum field at which up to which superconductivity can exist. So from here, I can solve for H from omega C. Omega C has this H naught, and that gives me H naught is equal to phi divided by phi naught divided by 2 pi 2n plus 1 over c square minus kz square. And here I should also write down phi naught is h c over e star. Okay, so from here we can see that the smallest, this implies that the smallest eigenvalue at n equal to 0 and kz equal to 0 corresponds to the highest field. And that gives us HC2, which is by definition that highest field, is phi naught over 2 pi C square. Okay? Beautiful. And what is even more beautiful is the meaning of this. What you're seeing is, okay, let me push it up first. Okay, so we have the system. Let's draw it like this. And vortices are starting to nucleate, right? These are these lines. So these are vortices. The magnetic field outside is pointing in this direction. That's the external field. Around each vortex, So around each vortex, there is a magnetic field which looks like this. So this is some B of R. This is R. And we can show this. We haven't shown it today, but we can, that B of R is phi naught over 2 pi lambda square times this Bessel function, k0 of r over lambda. And k0 of x looks like this. At small x, it goes logarithmically, log of x. And at large x, it goes like e to the minus x. And at x equal to 0, I should put a little squiggle here, because at x equal to 0, it approaches the external value. So here, it is h external. Okay, so this equation doesn't work all the way up to x equal to 0. Okay, so that's the magnetic field. And now, what we are saying in that equation is that as I look at increasing magnetic fields from here to here, this is hc2 of t. As I look in this region going up in magnetic field in the region that has the lattices, the lattice constant is not constant. It changes with the magnetic field. Okay, so here when I just enter the system at this point, the lattice is very far apart. And as I come toward this, the lattice gets much closer. In fact, the cores start to overlap. So hc2 is defined by that magnetic field at which, and you remember that the core size was c, that magnetic field at which the cores start to overlap. And the cores were normal. So clearly, if the normal cores have started to overlap, you've destroyed superconductivity. So that's how you get hc2 times the length square, c square, of order phi naught, then gives you that condition at which the normal cores will overlap and completely destroy the superconductor. Yeah, question? No. The size of the core is, the lambda is always the size over which the circulating currents move. Okay? By definition, lambda is the sheath of circulating currents. By definition, C is the region over which the order parameter is vanishing. So that's defining the normal core. So in this picture, this is the case we are considering, right? In this picture, the cores are normal, and when I draw them as a line, this is a very tiny core. And the currents are circulating. So this was the scale lambda L. And the current, if I had to draw the current, it would be J supercurrent as a function of R. It would circulate on this scale. So this is how it would look, also on the scale of lambda. Okay, so this completes our discussion of the type 2 superconductors. Any questions? Yeah. Say that again.
Shouldn't that maximum of PR be I mean, a little bit more than external?
More than the external? You mean here? At this point?
Yes.
Why? Because it cannot be more than that. So that's the, if the system was normal, that is how much field could go through that.
Yeah, that's true.
And it's only the fact that you have some circulating currents that cancel some of the field. Now, in the normal core, there are none of these circulating currents. So it remains the same value as the external one. As you cancel some of it, then the effective B is going down. And this is now within the system, away from the core. This point right here was the core.
Yeah, but, well, I guess energy levels, I mean, yeah, they somehow, I mean, when we look at energy levels, then they are possible, I guess. That's something I remember, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, okay, so think a bit more about it. It's very similar to what we derived even without the vortices, right? Even without the vortices, if you had the Meissner effect, it was shielding the currents and the magnetic field decreased from the external value because of the shielding. Now, what you're seeing is a situation where some of the normal stuff has gotten into the superconductor. But once again, the same shielding physics now happens around each core. So around each core, there are circulating currents. So if this is the magnetic field, there will be circulating currents like this. Okay? And the circulating currents will cancel some of the magnetic field. So each core in the center has the external field, but it cancels some of it around it. And it is these, the fact that, so, you know, I talked about how these vortices are making a lattice. That interaction is coming from this, the fact that the current field is going out to much larger distances than just the core. The currents are circulating over a much larger distance. And that's what then cancels the, that's what then generates the interaction between the vortices. Okay? What? Where does it come from? No, so what we derived here is the actual derivation. I was just motivating it by saying that you can make a hand-waving argument for 8C2 as being that field such that field times length, some appropriate length scale, is of order 1 flux quantum, right? And we talked about how that length scale was lambda for 8C1, and for since lambda is much bigger, 8C1 is a much smaller field such that the product gives you phi naught. Now, C has become much shorter, so you need to put a much larger magnetic field to enclose the same phi naught. Okay, good. So let's march on to the last part. Let me at least introduce the effect, and we can discuss it in more detail in the afternoon. But this is truly the climax of superconductivity, and that is Josephson effect. So once again, Josephson was motivated by this question whether the phase of the order parameter is something that could be measured. And as we've talked about, you know, the absolute phase is not measurable, but the relative phase, we have seen it in action in so many different ways. But he wanted to come up with a very direct way of getting a handle on the relative phase. So what he suggested was to take two superconductors. So here are two superconductors across a junction. So here is superconductor one, superconductor two, and then a little insulating barrier in between. Okay, so this superconductor will have its order parameter with some mod psi e to the I theta 1. This will have its order parameter. Let's just take it to be the same. So we can focus on the phase, which is the important player now, e to the I theta 2. And what the Josephson effect is the following measurement. So you look at, you apply a voltage, and you measure the current. And what we have seen so far is that because the superconductor has a gap in the spectrum, you can only get a current if you apply sufficient bias on the system. And you have to cross the gap. Now, this is across two superconductors, so it's a 2 delta gap. And beyond that, you get a current which grows with the square root behavior. This is coming from quasi-particles. So let me write down broken. Let me be very explicit. So this is broken electron pairs. And it's these broken electrons which then contribute to the current. So this is, yeah. But the Josephson effect is something rather bizarre. If I look at zero bias, what Josephson predicted is that there will be a current at zero bias. So this is the Josephson current that exists at V equal to zero. So that is what was bizarre. Here is a system with a gap. You don't apply any bias, no bias on the system, and yet there is a current. The chemical potentials are the same, and yet there is a current. And what is this current due to? He showed that I so this is called actually the DC Josephson effect. So there's no applied bias. Delta mu is equal to zero, which implies that theta d. Okay, let me not go there right now. So no applied bias, and still there's a current I, which is IC sine of theta, where theta is equal to theta 2 minus theta 1. So let's just ponder this a little bit, because it is rather an amazing effect. To get currents, you have to put some pressure head or some voltage or something to move particles, right? Here we are putting no such bias, no pressure heads, and still a current is being produced. And that current is coming from the fact that the phases on the two sides are different. So this current is directly related, directly proportional to the phase difference of the superconductors on the two sides. And that's why it was so amazing, that it was a direct measure of something like a phase that, you know, didn't seem to be very tangible. And what is more is that he showed that this current is due to tunneling of pairs. Okay, so that's even more bizarre. Yes.
No, it's the actual difference.
Yeah.
So is it different in the direction of the
you can say that. It's modulo 2 pi, of course. So okay, let's think about the second point that I wrote down. He showed that this current is due to tunneling of pairs. So now imagine what is happening. You have a junction which does not allow one electron to go through, right? There's a block because of the gap. But somehow two electrons, and this is the Cooper pair is able to go through the barrier. Bizarre. But that was his prediction. And that's why he got the Nobel Prize for it, because nobody believed it in the beginning, but he turned out to be right, because you can make that device and actually measure that current. Yeah.
So are you saying that if you apply an infinitesimal voltage to it, the current disappears?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah?
So I guess the way to do that experiment is to put the device that you've drawn into a circuit where you can control the current. And then I guess you measure the voltage across the device. And then what you're saying is that would be zero as long as the current that you're running through it is less than IC.
Yeah. So yes, that's right. So when you as we talked in the very beginning, when we were looking at a superconductor, how do you measure the resistance of a superconductor? You do it by making a current source. And the current source is made by putting a big resistor with a voltmeter, with a battery, and that generates a current source. And this current is going through your superconductor, and you're measuring the voltage across it. And the voltage across is going to remain zero until you hit a critical current. And this critical current turns out to be, so the critical current is going to be on the order of some property of this junction. And we will look at this a little more in the afternoon. So it will be related to something that I will define to be a Josephson energy, which is, and I will get into this more in the afternoon, and it will be related to a transmission coefficient T square across the junction. So this is a transmission probability and this is also proportional to the normal state conductance of that junction. Okay? But again, coming to your question, what will happen is that you will get some, you will be passing some current, there will be no voltage across the system, and then the system will go into a will develop a voltage. And let me draw something like this. This is the normal state. Okay, so it'll go from there, and it'll flip to this, and then it'll become like a single particle current. So it'll go like this, then you'll go up this thing. If you bring the voltage down, then you'll come down. And actually, I should have made it. Okay, never mind for now. That's good. Good enough.
will be it. Yeah. Is the
so
yeah.
You get this trees, is that right?
Yeah. So I was trying to draw that. Let me do that a little better.
Actually, isn't it easier to draw isn't it easier to draw a voltage versus current? Because then it's zero between plus and minus IC, and then it jumps to the linear Ohm's law.
Yeah.
I think that's, is that, I think,
yeah,
I'm not
that,
that, sure.
That is also, one can do it that way. Usually, yeah, I could also invert it and draw it that way, but let me just finish this curve a little better. What I want to draw is,
Oh, I see. It probably goes up like this.
So the crucial thing is this. I make, so let's not lose sight of the main thing, which is that I have made a junction. And across the junction, there's a phase difference between the two sides. The way the current at zero bias is being generated is by tunneling of pairs. Okay, so the tunneling of pairs is what generates this current at zero bias. And it's only if I hit a bias which is larger than 2 delta do I see the single particle current. But we are not interested in that at all. We want to focus on this part. And the reason this was so surprising is that if, you know, you would typically think if you're doing a quantum mechanical calculation that if the probability for one electron to tunnel is t square, that's the probability of going through the barrier, the probability of 2 electrons to tunnel would be t to the fourth. Okay, so that's why it seems completely improbable that 2 electrons would be able to go through. But the crucial thing is that they are not just 2 incoherent electrons. These are 2 electrons which are part of a condensate. And this actually comes out of a very nice microscopic calculation, which I will sketch in the last lecture this afternoon. And because these 2 electrons are part of a condensate, the tunneling probability is still proportional to t square. And the current then is this coefficient. So this is what dictates the maximum current that could go through. And it's given by the sine theta of the difference between the two. Now, that was the DC effect. So let me just end the last part. Yes. Okay, that's a good point. So going in, suppose I just take 2 superconductors, a piece of niobium and a piece of aluminum, right? Both are superconductors. Going in, I don't know what their thetas are. It's just some are each superconductor has chosen some, has broken this U1 gate symmetry and picked a theta. We call left one to be some arbitrary theta 1, right is some arbitrary theta 2. We can't measure the absolute values. But the relative phase will be in general different, right? You can't, the relative phase will be some value which is going to be different every time you make it. But that relative phase is what the current will pick up.
So you mean you know it's arbitrary and you can measure sine of theta, yeah.
Yeah. But actually what is done is to look at it in the AC mode, where you drive now. So this is this has even, so now you drive the system with a bias. So let me look at AC Josephson effect. So now you put an external bias. You put an external bias, which is constant. So some delta mu, which is E times V. Okay? So now d theta by dt,
theta is the relative phase. So let me write down theta is theta 2 minus theta 1. So now the relative phase is going to change with time, and it will be equal to 2EV over H bar. It's the chemical potential across it. And that gives me theta of t as a function of time is some constant plus 2EV over H bar times t. And so the current I will be IC sine So what that implies is that a DC bias has generated an AC current with frequency omega equal to 2EV over H bar. So that usually doesn't happen. You drive it with some frequency and the voltage with some frequency, and you get a current at the same frequency in a linear device, or if you have inductors or capacitors, they shift it. But here, a DC bias is generating an AC current. Okay, so this is the AC Josephson effect. But what you want to, in your mind, you should always keep in mind the first one, which is really where the relative phase comes in. And now in the afternoon, what I will show you is that from here, this idea has been taken into what are called SQUIDs. These are superconducting quantum interference devices. So you use these kinds of Josephson effects, make a ring, and use the interference across two Josephson junctions. And from using that kind of an interference effect, it makes one of the most sensitive devices to measure magnetic fields. So we will look at how this Josephson effect behaves in a magnetic field and how that is used to make a squid. Okay, thank you.